Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I want to remind everyone that because of COVID-19, we are Zooming. We are Zooming the afternoon before, so if something should happen on Sunday night, it will not be covered by my fabulous, fabulous Rethink the Week panel. But remember, it's called Rethink the Week, so we're looking backwards, we're not looking forwards. Before I introduce my guests, let me remind you we begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Colonel Vindman. As you know, Colonel Vindman has now retired. In other words, he was forced out because he was being treated so horrifically. And as Adam Schiff said, he really is an example of what a patriot sounds like. So, of course, this is the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in 2019 during the impeachment hearings of Donald Trump.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Rethink the week. Oh my God. It's a week. It feels like a year. But with Trump, everything is a year by the day. Our panel for this week is Dean Spiliotis. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also can be heard on New Hampshire Public Radio. He does their sort of end of the week wrap up. And he has a blog site called nhpoliticalcapital.com. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you. From lovely, lovely North Carolina. North Carolina State is Stephen Green. North Carolina has been in the news actually quite a bit, but again, sometimes that's not always a good sign. And Stephen Green is a professor of political science at North Carolina State. Welcome back, Stephen.
Great to be back with you.
And from the lovely, lovely state of Rhode Island is Val Endres. She is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. Let me welcome back Val Endres.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So we air this show, and the show originates in Concord, New Hampshire. And New Hampshire was sort of front and center for about 48 hours, Dean Spiliotis, because it turns out that Donald Trump wanted to have a rally at Pease Air Force Base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in the middle of a COVID-19 event. And they were, I guess, accommodating some of the nervous people in the crowd, including his own staff, by saying, well, you know, their masks will be available, hand sanitizers will be available, and they were offering tickets to people so they can attend this event. So, Dean, we know the governor was in a rock and a hard place. And Chris Sununu said, I will greet the president on the tarmac. I'll be wearing a mask, but I will not be attending the event because I'm worried about my children and my family and my health. Okay. He did not mandate masks, and masks were not going to be mandated. And then we find out that Donald Trump decides to cancel the event at the last minute because of a storm. And I send out to all of you, and it will also be on the Facebook page, the former chairman of the GOP, a guy named Fergus Cullen, sent out a hysterical tweet. And there was some plastic furniture that had blown over because it turns out it was a beautiful day in Portsmouth. That evening when the rally was supposed to happen, it was like picture perfect. And he said, don't worry, there was some wind, but we will rebuild, Donald. Thank you for not showing up. Trump did not come. And I'm wondering whether it was because the turnout wasn't going to be great, whether it's because he knew he was putting the Republican governor between a rock and a hard place, or whether he is beginning to realize that there's pressure on him not to hold these public events. Because in the end, we saw what happened in Tulsa. After his rally in Tulsa, they saw a spike in COVID-19. And ironically, not only did he not show up for the rally, but what did he do? He went to a hospital, a VA hospital, and I almost had a heart attack. He was wearing a mask, Dean Spiliotis. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can read me the political tea leaves, but there's something strange going on.
Yeah, I think there really were a confluence of events that came together to really push against the idea of him having a rally up here. You know, you mentioned one of them. It was the likely spike in COVID cases in Oklahoma after the Tulsa rally. I think that scared people. Having our governor say, I don't feel safe enough to be there in the crowd. And that's a Republican governor saying that. That's some pretty good negative signaling. I didn't see, as much as our businesses here on the seacoast are struggling just like everyone else with the economic devastation from the pandemic, you didn't see people rolling out the welcome mat from outer staters who were most likely going to be the ones who made up the audience, people driving in from elsewhere. And that has been something that New Hampshire has very judiciously guarded against, setting up any kind of incentives that might bring people in from out of state to spread the virus. And, you know, at this point, you look at the data, and we're one of only a half dozen states at the moment anyway, who seem to be keeping it either flat or slightly decreasing, kind of keeping it at bay. And so I just think it really, the idea of having that kind of rally here now was kind of really a misreading of public sentiment on the ground here in New Hampshire. This is also, frankly, I think a much tougher state for him this time around. This isn't going to be like the Republican primary in 2016. So, you know, the weather, you know, in fairness, there at some point there was this tropical storm that looked like it might track, but by the time they canceled, it had already kind of moved off of a more threatening course. And, you know, as you know, he got trolled mercilessly on Twitter with people, you know, pulling out Sharpies to correct the course of the tropical storm and people sending him sunny weather forecasts, et cetera, et cetera. Just bad timing, bad reading of the public sentiment here. You know, they said they're going to redo it in a couple of weeks. I'll believe it when I see it.
I've already got a $10 bet on that one. So, Stephen Green, a couple of things I want to talk about, because not only did they cancel, not only did they use that same time frame for him to be wearing a mask, okay, which I think is kind of interesting, but I think the whole mask thing is now boxing him in. And not only do I see what happened with my governor saying I'm not going to attend because I need to protect my family, I don't care about your family, but I'm going to protect my family. And then you have literally 48 hours before that, Governor Abbott mandating masks in the great Republican state of Texas. Now, this guy has been basically doing whatever the president wanted. He is, you know, he opened Texas too soon. He overrode, you know, the county judges when they wanted to mandate masks. He said no. And all of a sudden, because of this incredible spike with COVID-19, that's overwhelming, especially Houston, which is the largest medical center in the world. I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, they got more beds per person than anywhere else. And to see Chris saying what he said, Sununu, to seeing Governor Abbott doing what he's doing, to seeing that it's in his states that the spike is happening, I think he's having a breakdown. I think it's not working, this garbage about, you know, social distance if you want, don't wear a mask, and Fauci made a lot of mistakes. That's basically been his theme, Steve.
Yeah, no, I mean, as, you know, thousands of people have said, the virus doesn't care about politics, and the virus spreads better when people are not wearing masks. It's really clear. And you know, it really is interesting then to see the break of governors like Abbott, who have been completely Trumpist, who at some point, you know, they have a state that they have to take care of and have hospitals getting overwhelmed and are not in complete denial and delusion about things like President Trump. And again, President Trump, somebody fantastically lacking in empathy and concern for others. You know, say what you will about Greg Abbott, my guess is he would actually prefer Texans don't die. And on some level, this gets through to him. And I would have hoped it would have been sooner. So in the end, even the most Trumpist governors, I think, you know, will do more of the right things to help minimize this, but as we've seen so many times, the longer you wait to do the right things, the worse your outbreak is, and so much is baked in the cake. And I don't want to say it's too little too late, but it's probably, you know, too little too late.
You nailed it. And let me tell you why, Val. So as I'm thinking about the rally that didn't happen, and even though they said they were going to offer masks and hand sanitizer, what we know about being a Trump supporter is that you don't wear masks. That's your virtue. You don't hand sanitize. That's your virtue. You hold hands with everyone. You scream, you yell, you spit. Okay.
And I have to interrupt and say, there's this great article, and we talk about virtue signaling. There's this idea with Trump supporters of vice signaling. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It is vice signaling.
I love you. A perfect word. I've never heard it, but I'm going to use it a lot now. So they vice signal. Now, what is, and not only because of what's going on with Tulsa, but that's why, so New Hampshire has one of the lowest, you know, community spreads in the country. But what we know is even if they were coming from states that have low community spread, Val, the people that were showing up are the only ones that are ignoring all the virtue and they're embracing the vice. So once again, it is a super spreader event because Donald Trump, by definition, is the fulcrum of a super spreader event. And I don't care whether they came from, you know, the Vatican. They'd be the ones that wouldn't be wearing the mask at the Vatican. That's how bad it is. So I think what happened, not only did he have to cancel the rally, but I think Donald Trump is getting such pressure now from the business community, from the education community, from his own political staff going, you are screwing this up and you are killing our base. That's who you are killing. You are killing our base, Val.
Well, and the polls are showing that as well, where the latest polls are indicating that 67% of the public disagree with how he's handling COVID-19. And that's starting to eat into his base.
Yeah.
And he has a real dilemma here because the rallies are his reason for being, particularly in a campaign season. They were successful for him in 2016.
It's his drug of choice.
And I think what's as we see COVID-19 hit the southern states, it's increasingly going to affect his base. You know, before when it was in New York and other states, it was further away from his base. I think a consequence of this, and I'm not sure it was just New Hampshire, I think probably the campaign team may pivot a bit and try to figure out what other kind of alternative do they have. Will this make Trump, for example, more likely to debate? Because he's at least getting out there and talking to his base. And he very desperately needs to be able to do that. He has to rally them. He has to get them to vote for him in November. And so he's got to find something that will replace that. And we all know that he'll be attacking Biden and he'll be talking and pivoting and talking about the economy and how good it was before. But he still has to figure out what to do. And quite frankly, this may be the very end of the rallies, at least for the next couple of months.
The largest Republican convention in the country is in Texas, in Houston.
Yes.
It was canceled by the mayor of Houston. This it's bigger than the GOP convention. This is the Republican convention in Texas. And everyone is kind of grateful that they're basically, I mean, they were going to hold an in-person convention and they're blaming the Democratic mayor of Houston. But you know what? He's the fall guy. They're grateful that he did this because they don't really want to show up either. Ken, you're raising your hand. I know you want to weigh in.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment and then I'll weave it into what you're talking about now. When Steve was talking before about Governor Abbott and maybe he cares more about his public than Trump cares about anybody other than himself, I think, you know, Steve's a wonderful guy and he's very generous, but I don't know that I would give Governor Abbott that much credit. I mean, I think that what's happening with Abbott and more of the GOP people around the country is that they are seeing their own political hides. I mean, most politicians worry about their own political hides, and Trump certainly only worries about number one, and he doesn't care what happens to anybody else. But, you know, Abbott did whatever Trump told him to do and is now getting hammered for it because his state is suffering as a result. And so he's saying, I'm going to protect my own. Abbott territory. And
that's saying. That's kind of what Dallas is.
But it's more political. And that's why people are changing, you know, and senators, the GOP in every state around the country are running scared. And I think we're on the cusp of a break with Trump just to save their own hides everywhere else.
Yeah. And I got to say, that's why Trump is so bad at this. Right. You know, all of these things he should have been doing is to quote John Bernstein, a political scientist in Texas. He is bad at presidenting, you know, and Greg Abbott understands, look, I can't have all these people dying if I want to get reelected and do things politically. You know, all these other governors understand this. And Trump doesn't even really understand that. All he knows how to do is seek attention and grift the American people.
But Dean, I'm just going to remind everyone. How did Beto almost win Texas? So we already know there's a softening of their GOP hold in Texas. There was almost a loss of the governor of Florida against the Democrat running in Florida. There was almost a loss of the Republican governor of Georgia against the Democrat running in Georgia. They were already softening up those states before the pandemic, before Donald Trump got even crazier than he did, before the economy tanked. Dean Spiliotis, I mean, that's where the Republicans should be like in therapy because, you know, Donald Trump has made what was already a fragile situation in their state going into this election because you saw the precursors. They didn't win, but they didn't lose by much. They lost by a hair, Dean. And now you've got everything going wrong. And I mean everything from death to the economy to opening schools. Everything sucks.
Yeah, and Florida in particular has been instructive. You know, Governor DeSantis has really now found himself out on a limb by himself with President Trump. Even some of the other governors we mentioned, like Governor Abbott, have sort of eventually, slowly but surely, figured things out and are now changing course. But not, you know, DeSantis has been largely unrepentant. I see him on the TV every day giving press conferences, making the same kinds of arguments he's been making for weeks. And then we have that ridiculous self-righteous clip where he's demanding an apology a few months ago. And, you know, yesterday they logged the highest number of cases in a single day ever, worse than New York, worse than anywhere else in the country. So I think what we're finding, go back to an earlier comment, that President Trump really has a fairly limited repertoire. He's not particularly flexible. He's not good at adjusting on the fly for all of his kind of vaunted shoot from the gut communication skills. You know, we've seen this before. It worked for him in 2016. He tried it again in 2018. It didn't work for him in 2018. He's basically doing the same kind of stuff again for 2020. And it doesn't appear to be working for him, at least at the moment. And so it's an opportunity for Democrats. But, you know, they obviously need to make the most of it.
Well, so I know, Steve, you want to talk about schools, and we are going to talk about schools because the whole school thing is, I mean, you can chop it up into 12,000 different pieces. And what's great about it is I've got three professors on, all of whom are, this is personal to the three of you, because it's about how you're going to behave, how your students are going to behave, whether you're going to lose your foreign students, because again, you heard Dean Spiliotis say that the president doesn't know how to be flexible. Well, the one thing you have to be, Stephen Green, when you have a pandemic, is freaking flexible. That's the only way you can actually figure it out because the pandemic doesn't understand rigid, you know? And I think that's where the whole school thing is becoming an issue. And we can start with where you want to start with schools. Do you want to start with schools at the university level, which is personal to you because of your job? But what's also personal to you is you have young kids. So you're like, you're a sandwich. You're school on both pieces of bread. They both have mold on it.
I mean, the truth is, you know, I have three kids in K-12, and my oldest starting at NC State with me in the fall. We'll see whether in person or not. But, you know, the truth is, on this K-12 level, it's a disaster. It's what's going on. So much of modern American life and, honestly, economic productivity is absolutely predicated on kids being in school. And, you know, from the very beginning, that needed to be our number one priority is how do we make this work so that we can successfully have kids in school? And number one is that doesn't mean you reopen bars and restaurants to, quote, reopen the economy. That means you suppress this virus as far as you can so that it's actually safe to open schools and look at what they have done in Europe. And, you know, again, even you know, so many reasons we haven't accomplished that. But even still, there's all these lessons that we can learn, be it Germany or Denmark or Japan or Korea, and about, you know, what we might want to do with schools. And we're not learning them. And you know, my kids, hey, their dad's a college professor. There's going to be they'll be fine. But, you know, these gaps that we have are just going to get bigger and bigger and worse and worse. And you know what? It's actually not fine for my kids. It's going to suck. And yeah, so end rant. Sorry. It's the ultimate failure of our system of government that we cannot safely have our kids in school this fall. It's a horrible indictment starting at the top with Donald Trump.
And again, just the way the pandemic has torn off the ugly scab where we see that because of poverty, because you're an African American or Hispanic, or you're that frontline worker that we never valued at the grocery store or in the nursing home, we suddenly realize who's dying from this, who can't, you know, work from home and must leave the house in order to work. It showed all the inequality that we have. And now with the demand by Betsy DeVos and the president to open schools, as you just heard from Stephen Green, the inequity is going to be even worse. And let me tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of the schools I know, the poor schools in my state, where the basketball gym looks like it has moguls on, okay? Because they haven't been able to repair the gym in 40 years. They don't have a good air conditioning system or a heating system. They have the oldest teachers because good young teachers don't want to get paid crap and live up in those areas. So when you begin to look at even opening schools, the haves and the have-nots, who's going to really be dying is going to be the people in the poor school districts compared to what they're going to be able to do in the wealthier school districts. It's not a switch. It's not K through 12. It's poor K through 12 and rich K through 12.
All of this gets solved if we had federal support. And so I can talk about that from higher education, but I can also talk about it from K through 12. In higher education right now, because they got a little bit of CARE money, and for the example with the state of Rhode Island, the state scooped up that money that was designed for PPEs and for community tracing into the general state fund. And so schools feel as if it's an economic necessity, and also the demographics are against us anyway, they have been for the last decade, to open, to get the money from the dorms and to get people back and have them pay tuition. So a lot of schools, including my own, for example, we are going online, but we're not announcing it to students. And there's this great bait and switch that's happening in that they really don't want to tell them that we're going online because they don't want to lose them to another school. Now for K through 12, if we look at funding, you know, and Steve made such a good point about closing the bars and the restaurants. We know that it is all about Trump's economy, that the only way that both parents can get back to work and is if their kids are in school. And so we haven't supported people. We had one disbursement of funding for everybody, and that was it. And I've read a lot of analyses that say we should be on our fourth or fifth payment from the federal government.
All right, on that note, we need to end this first section because we have to go to a break. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's our Rethink the Week. Val Endres, Steve Green, Dean Spiliotis are joining us. We'll be back in a moment.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day newspapers throughout the South announced the return of Ida Sledge to Tupelo, Mississippi. The ILGWU organizer had been leading unionization efforts at three area mills. Twice, she was driven out. Prominent businessmen invited her to leave town just days earlier, warning her not to return under the threat of violence. Earlier that spring, workers had held a sit-down strike at the Tupelo Cotton Mill. They demanded higher wages and shorter hours in the town's first labor action ever. The mill's stockholders responded by voting to liquidate. Sledge immediately filed charges with the NLRB against the mills for violating the Wagner Act. Now, newspapers reported a tense atmosphere in Tupelo with Sledge's return. She stated, quote, "I don't mean to cause any trouble. I intend to organize the garment workers and don't propose to be scared away." The Citizens Committee soon declared victory, claiming they had organized 1,000 workers at 5 plants into independent home unions. Sledge condemned these as company unions. By the end of the month, Democratic Representative of Mississippi John Rankin thundered, "These representatives of the so-called Labor Relations Board boasted they were going to close every factory in the city before they quit, and when they got through with it, there would be no Tupelo left." The following spring, local organizer Jimmy Cox was taken outside of town and flogged by 15 men. Sledge was again threatened and driven away permanently. The mill owners finally relented in August as the NLRB trial loomed. They disbanded their company unions, reinstated fired workers with back pay, and posted notices that they would not interfere with organizing efforts. But unfortunately, the ILGWU never gained much from their organizing efforts. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Change, change, change. Change, change, change.
Of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It is our Rethink the Week with our fabulous panel. Val Endres is a political communications expert and professor at Rhode Island College. Steve Green is a professor in political science at North Carolina State. And Dean Spiliotis is a presidential scholar and a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Well, we're talking school, mostly for the most part, really looking at sort of K through 12. But I want to go to Dean Spiliotis because Dean, you came out of the box, and you told me this weeks ago, that Southern New Hampshire University was going to go all online, give everyone the benefit of a lower cost all online. And what I think I know about SNU is that you have a significant number of foreign students at Southern New Hampshire University. So tell me, given what they're now coming down with both foreign students and the whole online thing, how is SNU re-threading the needle? Because this is challenging your entire academic model.
Yeah, we did announce fairly early on that we were going to be all online for the fall semester. I wouldn't be surprised if it's the entire year, but I don't think that's been announced, and I don't have any particular inside information on that. We do have a large foreign student population, international students. SNHU is very popular with international students. It's something I think the administration is now going to have to deal with, as are, there have been a number of schools that have filed lawsuits or part of a lawsuit, I think initiated by MIT and Harvard. And so they may get some kind of an initial stay on that, but it is a big concern for all of our many international students. SNHU, in fact, before we announced that we were going to be online due to the pandemic, the school announced a longer term initiative to shift even our residential program to online. So you can still come to SNHU, you can live on our residential campus, do you know, student activities, sports, et cetera, but your content would be online, and that would allow them to lower tuition, not room and board, you'd still pay room and board, but tuition, as is the case for this year, will drop from about 31,000 to about 10,000 per year. So they understand that their kind of segment of the higher ed market are really is really tuition sensitive. And in fact, by announcing early that they were going to drop tuition from 31 to 10, filled the freshman class, no problem at all. And so the big outstanding question now is, what about our international students? And I we're only just starting to get communications. But I will say, as you know, Arnie, I have a daughter who's going off to college, and that's a very different model. Right now, they're all going to get single rooms, and they're going to have to wear masks and social distance in the classroom, takeout dining center. That's where they are right now. I don't know whether that's where we'll be in 2 months, but it is remarkable to watch the incredible turmoil that this is causing in higher ed, even for schools with big endowments, billion-dollar endowments, but certainly for kind of the middle tier of universities who depend on tuition in order to keep functioning.
So, Stephen, I got to ask you a question, because you teach at a public institution, North Carolina State. And I don't know what the percentage of foreign students are, but I will tell you about my state. And that is, they love foreign students. They love out-of-state students because they pay full freight. And when you are sort of been starving your higher ed from your, you know, your state dollars, you really need these students in order to make sure that you can keep the electricity on, the professors and the faculty working. And there was a talk that one of the ways they were going to sort of thread the needle is that they were going to offer like one in-person class for the foreign students so they could take 90% of what they're doing online, but for the one, they could show up, and this way they could sort of say, screw you to Betsy DeVos and ICE and the president and whatever. And they're going to sort of figure out how they can do this. I'm not sure that's going to work, but the fear I have right now is that what we're learning is that Donald Trump is not only hurting these academic institutions, which are going to just even put more greater drain on their state revenues, but I showed a map of all the countries that will not allow the United States in, okay? And I'm thinking about what they're doing with this. I'm looking at the map. I mean, it's just like, we are toxic. We are toxic on every level. And the only success to Donald Trump and a wall is that he has built a wall around us. There is now a moat around the United States. He's not keeping people out. Nobody wants us out. They don't want us, so I don't know what they're talking about at North Carolina, but this is really terrifying.
I mean, it's horrible. And again, North Carolina State is very big in science and engineering and brings in a lot of international students for that, which is a huge part of, you know, we absolutely depend on those funds. My department has a master's in international studies program that brings in a lot of foreign students and depends on those tuition dollars. And I'm optimistic we'll work something out, and that at least at NC State, we have enough in-person stuff that's at least planned to be going on. But I mean, again, the thing is, these immigrants who come to our country and participate in higher education are a huge net benefit to our society. I mean, obviously, like right now, short term, you know, this is bad for our university, but this is an export. Higher education is perhaps America's greatest export. And we're just like, don't buy. It's just a lose proposition, which I guess sums up Donald Trump's approach to policymaking.
Well, but Val, so as I'm thinking about all of this, there's a couple of things I'm thinking about. And that is, what are professors going to do if they have to have in-class participation? Most of the faculty who have tenure are old. They're old. That's part of the problem at many of these institutions, is that there hasn't been a lot of young blood that have been allowed in. So they probably are maybe a little overweight, hypertension. So they're hysterical about doing something where they have to actually distance and wear a mask and still produce some sort of class. So they're afraid. Then you can look at the setting in public education, and a lot of the older teachers, who are the more experienced teachers, are afraid about what's going to happen, because again, they're vulnerable. And then I'm going to throw one more piece in I just saw a group of Houston nurses want to go on strike because they don't have the right kind of protective equipment in order to treat the people that they already know have acute COVID. This isn't about testing, Val. This is about a national mandatory mask wearing. Because if you want schools to open, if you want businesses to open, if you want to take pressure off the hospitals, as much as testing is important, testing just says it's spread. Wearing a mask is like the only insurance we have to stop the spread. And I am just blown away about how this has now become this, you know, free speech cause celeb. And again, it is vice spreading because it impacts all these things that we're talking about right now.
Part of the problem in higher education is that you're depending upon the absolute cooperation of a group of people who feel less vulnerable. And certainly professors are very cautious about this. And there are all kinds of problems. You know, some are getting medical dispensations, or if you're 65 and older. And that forces you to reveal medical information that the administration has no business knowing. So there's all kinds of problems there. But as much as I love my students, and I'm sure that K through 12 people do, you're talking about a population that will very easily take off their masks because it's hot or they don't feel like they can be heard. There's all kinds of logistical issues that are involved there. And I think it's a separate argument when you're talking about medical facilities, because they're very highly trained and they understand how to protect. The problem is you can't necessarily translate that to the educational system.
We're facing just this cocktail of failure. And as I said before, each one of those failures is not just a separate failure, it's synergistic. They feed each other. And what's happening as a result is even bigger than each of the individual failures. So having said that, Dean Spiliotis, this is, after all, a political show. So let's go into a little bit of the politics of this Rethink the Week. I wanted to start with polls, but I can't. I got to start with Roger Stone. And the reason I got to start with Roger Stone is that, you know, Bill Barr must be so pissed off. I'm just furious. I mean, you know, he already groveled for the president as it is. But on top of that, now with this commutation, and I love Roger. The reason I love Roger is that Roger actually says to the world, he knows I know crap about him. And so one of the reasons why you have to give me a commutation is that I'm so good because I didn't rat on you, Donald Trump. I mean, it's disgusting. It's disgusting on every level. And I'm wondering, can we use what happened to Roger Stone? And Roger Stone basically sort of saying to the press, thanks, I won't rat on you now, as sort of another layer of reason for why there might actually be a tsunami in November. I think Roger Stone thing, all I want to do is like, I think we should all be taking a shower after we hear him talk.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to know at this point. There seems to be some discussion or debate over whether or not this is some kind of, final straw or tipping point or something. It's clearly, you know, I think clearly plenty of people think it's problematic. And as you said, it's very well maybe the case that he did this explicitly, that President Trump commuted the sentence explicitly to protect himself. And that's, you know, I think there's some lawyers would say that's probably not something you should be able to do, but he does have pretty broad latitude. So whether or not this kind of changes things, what's so interesting for me mainly is to watch the reaction or lack thereof, particularly from Republican senators. I think that's been the most interesting part of this. You know, people who already think Trump is sleazy, this is just another thing. People who think it's buy into the hoax witch hunt narrative, this was fine with them. But it's fascinating to me to watch how and if Republican members, particularly the Senate, do or do not react to this. I mean, you had Mitt Romney come out quite critically. You had Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania kind of come out critically. Lindsey Graham has now mentioned something about having Robert Mueller, who wrote an op-ed reaffirming the prosecution of Stone, maybe having him come testify. But overall, the silence to me, in fact, I think even Lindsey Graham at one point said that he was okay with the pardoning. The silence to me is what's really interesting. Whether or not this is something that fundamentally changes how Republican senators in particular view their strategy for November.
So, Steve, is Biden going to use this, or does he not have to, because the Lincoln Project will do it for him? I think we got the good cop, bad cop. And the Lincoln Project says, we love the dirt. We love Roger Stone. We love the lies. We're dying to like offer you chapters of Mary Trump's book. I think in a lot of ways what the Lincoln Project is doing is basically building this, again, a moat around Biden, so Biden can focus on the economy and on healthcare and on mask wearing and on COVID. And they then basically take all this ooze coming out of this administration and play it in 45-second ads.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I feel pretty confident and optimistic that Donald Trump will lose in November. But I also remain nonetheless, dare I say, depressed at the lack of regard for political accountability and the rule of law that we've seen in the American public. And I think the virtual non-response to impeachment was pretty clear on that. What Donald Trump did with Ukraine was despicable, and it didn't move public opinion. What Donald Trump has done with Roger Stone is despicable, and I don't think it's going to move but a handful of votes. What is moving votes, presumably, is the fact that last I saw somewhere only maybe mid or low 30s% approved of how Donald Trump was handling the pandemic. And I think he will very much lose because of that. But, you know, if we were going along just smoothing with clear sailing and no pandemic, Donald Trump could very well be reelected while being the most fabulously corrupt, unaccountable president in history. And that's really sad.
Steve, I think you're in La La Land. And let me tell you why. This is a very xenophobic country. We couldn't find Ukraine on a map. Russia, shmusha, okay? You know what I mean? I mean, even what's going on in Afghanistan, because we have a voluntary military and most of our kids aren't involved in it, even if it's the longest war in American history, you would not know it because look who's serving in there. So I think the reason why the whole story about Ukraine did not get the American people excited, the whole story even about the bounty didn't get people as excited as they should, the whole story about Russia being involved in the election didn't get them excited, is Val, the only thing that excites them is whether they can go to a doctor when they're sick, whether they're dying, or whether they have a job. And now what we have is the trifecta. They can't go to a doctor when they're sick because they're terrified because the doctor's office isn't open or they're like, you know, full of COVID. They may die because what we know is that COVID is now spreading with younger people, let alone older people. They've already wiped out all the nursing homes. And when it comes to the economy, it is imploding, Val. That is what gets the American people to care. I wish they cared about Ukraine. I wish they cared about the rule of law. I wish they cared about Roger Stone, but they don't. They're incredibly selfish. You know, it's all about me. And the problem is Donald Trump has failed them.
Well, it is reality show presidency that was brought about by the emphasis on individual rights versus collective responsibility. And I've talked about that a lot. But I also don't want to underestimate the amount of corruption that has been in our government before. It just wasn't talked about quite so blatantly. And so I'm a little bit more optimistic that maybe by having a Senate majority and being able to pass legislation that genuinely helps people, I think in some ways, how you overcome some of these problems that are so deep-seated that Steve talks about is that you start making the federal government work for people as opposed to being this obstacle for people. And I think that may move sentiment to the other side.
So Elizabeth Warren talks a lot about corruption, Dean Spiliotis. And she was talking about corruption even before she was really even talking about Donald Trump. And the corruption she saw was the corruption she saw with the economic meltdown of 2008, and nobody did a perp block. And the corruption, I mean, she has been seeing corruption for a long time. So I'm not going to lay the corruption only at Donald Trump. I don't remember who the senator was, but remember right after the 2008 economic meltdown, one of the U.S. senators was exasperated. And he said, oh, damn it, the banks own this place. And he was absolutely right. Donald Trump was a figment of our imagination in 2008. Nobody ever thought about him except that he was a corrupt real estate guy from New York. And that was about as far as he would get. So what scares me is we are putting a lot of our hope that the corruption that we see and that the changes that we want to make, is it possible or has the money and the revolving door and the monopolistic tendencies of so many of the businesses and what hedge funds are able to do and the kind of money they were able to get from Donald Trump's tax cuts, is that so embedded and so corrosive that while the Democrats talk an anti-corruption, a change game, are they going to be either break the leash or is the leash going to realize they need to release them or they're not going to even have a country to be corrupt in?
Yeah, you know, my concern is that what you just described, the scenario where the kind of underlying dynamics are really entrenched in our infrastructure and our bureaucracy and longstanding political and economic relationships. And in some sense, that makes Donald Trump really a symptom of the deeper problem rather than the cause of the problem. He certainly is kind of the most glaring extreme example we've had, but I don't think anybody is expecting, you know, Joe Biden to come in, you know, as a crusading reformer either. He'll calm things down a bit. You know, maybe the relationships will kind of go back to being a little bit more under the radar and less provocative. But, you know, these are much bigger, more difficult sets of relationships. And, you know, pretty much every president has always had some component of his or his message coming into office that he was going to be a reformer. You remember, wasn't Al Gore put in charge of reinventing government back in the 1990s? That was his sole,
he invented the internet.
Sole focus. And then he had the whole issue with campaign fundraising, if you remember that mini, mini scandal. So, unfortunately, I think that this is a much more potentially intractable part of our political system. Doesn't mean it can't be reformed, but simply making Donald Trump go away, I don't think is going to solve the problem.
Well, Stephen, what I'm thinking is that, so I'm listening to Joe Biden, and I'm actually reading The American Prospect, because that's kind of my lefty magazine that I read. So I'm trying to figure out what lens are they looking at Biden through, because they were not exactly thrilled with Joe Biden. And so Joe Biden now has got this sort of populist, I'm going to bring manufacturing back. A lot of what Donald Trump said, he's saying it. And when I read Robert Kuttner say, oh, wait a minute, you got to look at this. This may not be as crazy as you think. And what I realize is what I'm beginning to hear out of Joe Biden isn't actually Joe Biden. It's actually Elizabeth Warren. And I keep thinking, I have a plan for this. But it's coming out of the Biden mouth. But when you actually look at a lot of the content of what's coming out with these plans, it is very Green New Deal-ish, but it isn't called that. It is a lot of, I have a plan for that, but it isn't called that. And when you're beginning to look at some of the manufacturing, you know, we do need to make stuff again. It just makes sense. Not necessarily little tiny widget stuff, but the added value like you see in Germany. Germany has labor unions and Germany makes stuff. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing, Steve.
Yeah, no, Biden is not dumb. You know, he's got some skills and he can recognize where Elizabeth Warren has good ideas and that these are things that he would want to implement as president. And, you know, I think one of the things is, I don't know, I should probably not try and be optimistic because that usually ends up just hurting. But, you know, when you think about the Biden presidency and the kind of potential there is out there, the truth is really big things happen, come out of not necessarily bad times, but like dramatic times, right? And these are dramatic times. And this, the opportunity for Joe Biden to help bring about major change, which let's be honest, that's not really in his bones like it is for Elizabeth Warren. But nonetheless, the opportunity to do that and just maybe channel it from some other people coming out of the disaster of this pandemic and the disaster of Donald Trump's presidency is there really is going to be this opportunity to achieve and accomplish some liberal goals that honestly we would have a year ago probably never dreamed to go about as the opportunity.
I think the moment can make the man. And I think that's kind of what you're saying, Steve, is that the moment can make the man. And this is such an incredible moment on every level from the healthcare perspective, from the Black Lives Matter perspective, and the defund the police perspective, and I mean, just everything, okay? The international scene, where we're like a pariah on the international scene. So you're beginning to like re-even examine the Pentagon budget, going, what is security? Maybe it isn't building a bomb, you know? Maybe it's something else. So I really do think that the moment can make the man. And I think that that's one of the reasons why, even when you look at Black Lives Matter, it goes back to the whole manufacturing thing. And what is the manufacturing thing, and you know, raising the minimum wage and looking at healthcare? If you want to know why there's this gross inequality, it's because the jobs that people have that don't pay you, that mean you can't go to a doctor when you're sick, that you live in a toxic area, that's what's the driver of a lot of this Black Lives Matter. And it's not just the racism, it's this economy that says, oh, how convenient, we'll just put the black people there. You know, like somehow that's going to take care of it. And now everything is exploding, and it's about time.
Two really quick points. One is that in the book, The New Jim Crow, she talks about the fact that moving manufacturing outside of the United States blatantly hurt blacks and put them at risk and created that gap for inequality even wider than it was before. But I'm with Steve on this notion about being optimistic, because I go back to England creating national health care at their lowest point after World War II. And I think we wouldn't be talking about defunding the police right now if it weren't a confluence of factors that were coming into play. So I think that Biden is an opportunist, and he may compile these good ideas and move for change. I mean, it could be an incredible first 100 days.
And so, Dean, I'm going to end this way. So I run for governor and I lose, but I lose with more votes than any Democrat in history, even though I only got about 40%, but that should tell you about that election. Anyway, it was right after the economic meltdown in New Hampshire. We had lost all our banks, we lost all our real estate. Here's the good news. This is what I predict. Not only do I think Joe Biden will win, but there will be coattails. And there'll be progressive coattails. And what you just need is, you don't need 50% of the Democratic caucus to be liberal or progressive. You just need a critical mass. And what we are seeing is a critical mass. And you will see them show up. It's already begun to show up in New York. AOC was not a one-off. She won this time with 70%. Engel, the chairman of a committee, he lost to Bowman. You're seeing it happening. And so not only do you have these confluence of events, but you have this progressive voices coming in, not in the majority, but they don't need a majority. They just need to have enough of them there to actually create an amazing voice in the Congress.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. My concern, though, is that I'm a little less optimistic than other folks on the panel. You know, history is littered with modern presidents who have come into office with unified government. And you know, whether we're talking about Obama or Bill Clinton, there's progressive voices, and things typically very quickly fall apart, and then the other party gets seats back at the midterm. So I understand your point about the progressive voices, and that may pull Biden to the left, et cetera, but only if the executive and the legislative are able to work in concerted fashion. You know, the recent experience, you end up with so much kind of infighting because everybody tries to do everything all at once. And maybe that won't happen this time, but it's happened in the past.
So my gift to all of them will be shelve your ego. Shelve your ego. And with this, I want to thank my phenomenal panel for the Rethink the Week. Val Endres, Rhode Island College, Stephen Green, North Carolina State, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and of course, Ken Barnes, my producer. We'll talk tomorrow. Thanks, guys. Ciao. I